Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which will launch an RN to BSN program in January. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. Go to carthage.edu/BSN for more information. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. The story that we explore in the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show is a difficult, painful, complicated one, but also one that I think will leave all of us ultimately enriched. Certainly that is how I felt as I finished reading an extraordinary book titled The Objects That Remain. It is a book by one Laura Levitt, who is professor of religion, Jewish studies, and gender at Temple University, and the author of a couple of previous books, including American Jewish Loss After the Holocaust and Jews and Feminism, The Ambivalent Search for Home. This latest book, The Objects That Remain, is an intensely personal one for Laura Levitt and written only over the course of many, many years. At the heart of it is the fact that Laura Levitt herself is a graduate student back in the late 1980s, was brutally raped in her own home. And this book is, in a sense, a chronicle of her long journey to try and make sense of what occurred to her and to come to terms with the sad and even maddening reality that the person who raped her was never found and obviously never arrested and brought to any kind of justice. So, but this is far more than just the standard story of trying to close the circle or come to grips with something terrible. This is about a very different kind of search as well, and in a sense, an exploration of the objects in our lives that help us come to terms with our own history, with our own story, and of how sometimes those objects can help carry the story forward. And as she explores her own experiences with this, she is also exploring the wider story of objects remaining from the Holocaust and what those objects mean to the rest of us who grapple to understand such an incomprehensible horror. So there is a lot packed into this relatively small book. So in a sense, modest in its physical scope, but extraordinary in all that it explores. It is published by Pennsylvania State University Press, again titled The Objects That Remain. Professor Laura Levitt, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much, and what a beautiful introduction. I really appreciate your careful account of the book.
Well, it's really amazing, and actually, as I began reading it, even though I had, in a sense, a summary of it, I really had no idea all that was going to be housed within its pages. Ahead of us talking about your story and all that you explore in this book, can you say a word about just how long it took for this book to take shape? And maybe if you could kind of trace the arc of its history. I mean, is this something that you have, in a sense, kind of relentlessly, doggedly worked on over the course of many years? Or is this a project that, in a sense, you would have to take up and then relinquish for a time and take it up again? Give us some of the sense of the story of this book itself coming together.
Sure, Greg. I began thinking about the very beginning of the book is something that I recount early on, which is that I was finishing my last book, which is American Jewish Loss After the Holocaust, and it was really about how we grapple with ghosts in a different way and how we commemorate different kinds of losses and how different losses, both intimate and world historical, touch each other, not to become one and the same, but the ways in which they illuminate each other. and thinking about individual loss, for example, and thinking about the Holocaust and how those 6 million or 12 million people who died each have stories. And on the other hand, so much of what we know about trauma and memory and loss has been forged by scholars who've worked on the Holocaust and other genocides. And I think it's really that interplay that interests me. So I, in the process of finishing that book, I met the poet Maggie Nelson. We have mutual friends, and she had just written a book of poems called Jane a Murder about her aunt, a woman she never knew, who was murdered, and it was an unsolved case. And she tried to piece together a kind of conversation across time in that book of narrative poems, Jane a Murder. And when I met the poet, the book had just come out. It was about, I think it's 2005, I believe. And she was, as the book went to press, she learned that there was a break in this 30-some-odd-year-old cold case. And it was all based on DNA evidence. And when I met her, she had just been to a preliminary hearing in what became her aunt's murder trial. And what she saw in that courtroom for the first time, this is a woman who had tried to piece together her aunt's life and death with the shards that she had. And lo and behold, there were whole troves of things that she didn't know existed, including the clothing her aunt wore the night that she was murdered. And it was hearing about that woman's clothing that set me really on this journey. And this was, again, probably 05, 06, and I was, as I say, finishing up my last book. But I became fascinated because I'm someone who cares about clothing, and I like to play dress-ups since I was a child. I write about that in the book as well. I hadn't thought about the clothing and the bedding that was taken from my house the night that I was raped. I hadn't thought about the evidence in my case. And so that set me on this journey. And having finished once I finished that last book, I would say about 2008-09 is when I really began working on this book wholeheartedly. And although I was often teaching and busy with other things, this was my kind of, the book, the project was kind of an abiding presence in my life. And, you know, I will say that I worked on it pretty much all of the time. You know, I lost my mother in the process of writing this book. She died late in 2011, and that kind of slowed things down and was hard. But I just kept going. And so I began by asking what the police do with material evidence, but I knew from my work on Holocaust memory, and I had been working with photographs, which are themselves a kind of object, I started thinking about the other objects at places like the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And I really wanted to figure out, is there a connection between these things? So this was a kind of slow accretion. So I began with some of that work with the police. I did take a course with the cops. I found this organization that does police property management, and I was lucky enough, and they were kind enough to allow me to become an associate member of their organization and to take one of these courses. And eventually I was able to go to the Holocaust Museum and spend some time with many of the museum professionals there, particularly the conservator, Jane Klinger, who I write about in the book. But those were extraordinary experiences. And then I spent a lot of time reading, and reading very closely Maggie Nelson's work, not only Jane, but she ended up writing a book about the trial, a memoir called The Red Parts. And that became really formative for me. And I also kind of, that was one of the books that was formative. And the other was about Holocaust memory and objects. And that's Edmund Duval's The Hair with Amber Eyes, which is an unbelievably beautiful, stunning family memoir by Duval, who is also a world-renowned potter. So that's a bit of the trajectory.
Mm. I want to ask you one other thing about the trajectory of what you have experienced in your life in the wake of this terrible thing which you experienced in 1989. One of the things that you tell us about the way this has sort of played out for you, its aftermath, that is what you characterize at one point as kind of a series of dreams in which early on there was this, what you, I think, call kind of a waking nightmare, as we can all really easily understand, or can, I mean, we can understand what you're talking about, but that at some point that was taken up by a very different dream that you characterize as oddly euphoric. An elation built on the realization that this terrible thing had not ended your life, that you were able to live on. And it was only with your mother's death that that kind of euphoric second dream began to, in your words, unravel. I wonder, in the course of writing this book, is that when you understood this, or even as you were living it, were you aware of these sort of different dreams that were part of how you were, I suppose, processing and understanding what had happened to you?
It's a great question, and I appreciate it. The waking nightmare makes a lot of sense. It's one of those dreams where you're kind of in the room, but you can't get out of it, and that's kind of really what it felt like initially. But when this strange man attacked me and was choking me, I was keenly aware. It was like he was the embodiment of all of, there were so many crimes at that time and continue to be these kinds of crimes of women who've been assaulted and killed. There were a lot of them in Atlanta in 1989. And I thought he was the embodiment of the perpetrator of all of those, right? And I thought, oh, my God, I just can't die. And part of it was that I was finding my voice as a scholar and a writer and a teacher, and I was falling in love with the work that I was doing, and I didn't want to die. I really wanted to be able to live that out. That really stayed with me. And so the fact that I took my doctoral exams 2 months after I was raped, that I began writing my dissertation, that I got the one and only job that I applied for early in my career because my friend Janet Jacobson, who was ahead of me, saw this job posting and said, Laura, this job has your name on it. And I applied for it and I got it, and that's my job at Temple. And I finished my dissertation while beginning that position at Temple in 1992. And so part of what happened was I began to have all of the things that I imagined that I really wanted, and they were happening, and they were happening in a pretty a steady and very excited state. It was it really was euphoric. I had all of these things that I loved, and I was getting to live them out. And really my whole career, which began with that job in 1992, was really shaped by this experience. I don't know I wrote about my rape in my first book. I don't know who I would have been had this not happened to me, which is a loss that I can't touch. But that euphoria was great. I don't know that I was as keenly aware all the time. I think I couldn't articulate it probably as clearly until, as you note, by the time my mother died and I really felt the power and the sort of magnitude of, you know, our finitude and what dying and loss really look like, that I understood how charged and excited and elating that 20-year period was for me. And I feel great gratitude for having been able to experience it. And in part, I wanted to write about this because I think that so many folks think about survivors or victims and think about all of the terrible things. But we don't talk enough, I suspect, about, you know, the sort of power of, as my friend Janet says, she said, you know, in some ways I remained. So the objects remained, but I also remained. And she connected this to the name of my first dog, the dog that I got right after I was raped because I didn't want to live alone.
Mm.
And his name was Bleiben, which is the German verb to stay or to remain or to endure.
Mm.
And I really love that image.
And I, as someone who has had golden retrievers in my life for the last 15 to 20 years or so, really love the fact that a golden retriever, I think the most beautiful and faithful of all dogs, was such a comfort to you, gave me comfort in a strange way as I read about Bleiben in your book. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Laura Levitt about her latest book called The Objects That Remain, in which she talks not only about the brutal rape that she experienced in 1989, but the long journey in the wake of that, in part to understand the significance of the objects in our lives, and in particular the way in which the objects in our lives play a role in the shaping of our own stories and in the way in which we can understand the stories of others. Your book begins with a lovely prelude. I wish we had longer to talk about this because it is so intriguing. And I love that the book begins in this way, particularly given all that comes after that is, in a sense, so weighty and much of it difficult. But there's this lovely prelude in which you talk about your childhood and your love of objects, and in particular, clothing and shoes. A love of that that is a little out of the ordinary, I would say. Just briefly describe this to our listeners, because I think it really helps us, in a sense, to understand you and why you are exploring the things you explore in this book.
So, yeah, thank you so much. So as a little girl, I did talk to my clothing, and and I kind of personified them, and I'd have these kind of elaborate ideas about their feelings. So, you know, I'd put on these little girl undershirts, and the front of them had a nice bow, but the back didn't, and I felt bad for the back of the undershirt. So I found this way of putting them, if I put my undershirt on upside down and inside out, then the back got to be in the front some of the time, and I do actually often still put on tops this way. And sometimes I've been in gyms when we used to go to the gym, and I would just do this, and sometimes people would like look at me strangely because it was just so ordinary for me. I also talk about my school shoes, because back in the day we'd get like one new pair of shoes each year, and they would be your school shoes, and you'd wear them, and it was a big deal to go and get them. And I was very excited always about getting the new shoes, but then I'd come home and I'd have to kind of displace the old shoes. So I felt very sad about the old shoes. But it's been interesting with people beginning to read the book. I've had a couple of readers get back to me and say, oh my God, I have that. I also love my clothes. And I've heard stories about a dress that someone didn't like, and they felt badly that they didn't like that dress, and it sat kind of not worn in the closet. So I think there may be a cluster of us out there who have these experiences.
Interesting. You proceed from the prelude to the introduction of the book, in which you take us, in a sense, through the doors of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And as you enter this building, you see somebody on the staff there working with a garment, repairing actually a prisoner's uniform. And as you talk about this, you contrast what these kind of artifacts represent versus photographs. I think it is either someone's book or your own previous book that talks about photographs as those precious traces of life before. And yet these garments from the Holocaust represent something else that in a sense could be still more powerful and in a sense much more intimate. Tell us what you learned about the power of such artifacts, these garments from the Holocaust, to speak to us so powerfully.
Well, clothing is worn, and when we think about those prisoner uniforms, we have to remember that they were haphazardly doled out to the prisoners, and that's all they had to wear. And they wore them every day for the duration of their time in the camps. And so, they had to kind of make them work on different bodies. And so over time, the very kind of shape of the person to whom these garments belonged, take on that shape. And the uniform that I looked at, the jacket that I saw being mended, was actually a very elaborate jacket that had been quite carefully crafted. There were pockets and folds, and it was so someone who had been able to doctor it in a way. And it was, alas, in very, very bad shape. But what I think that I want to convey is that these are intimate objects that hold us, right? They hold us in our person. And they were there then with those prisoners, and they are here now with us. They were silent witnesses to what went on day by day in the camps. And so I describe how, in trying to maintain and to kind of make sure that these garments are kept as well as they can be, they're certainly not in pristine condition. I describe how the museum has created these hanging effigies, right? That kind of they create bodies for each of these garments to help ease the sort of the kind of weight on the seams and the panels. To keep them from falling apart, because they are that fragile. But I think if you think about those effigies underneath, it's kind of the reversal of the ways in which we think about clothing holding the person. But now here are these garments without people that need to have these other approximations of bodies to hold them as they carry on the memory of those who once wore them.
Right. And these are custom fit effigies. I mean, it's not
absolutely
not that they have been mass produced by the hundreds or thousands, but each one carefully shaped to fit that particular garment and its own unique characteristics and proportions.
Yes. And those are the people who wore them, right? That's it, it's how we can remember them, and I love that because this kind of shows us they're, even though we think about them in mass, but they are all individual.
Hmm. A little later in the book, you talk about the arts of conservation. You talk about the arts of conservation, not the art of conservation. And also the complicated matter of collections management, when one is entrusted with such precious objects, what to do with them, how to preserve them, how to present them to the public. But could you first of all take us inside that intriguing term, the arts of conservation?
Well, I think about art, another word that comes to mind now is rites, like in religious rites, that these are practices. So that if you think about a potter, someone like Edmond Duval, who has to makes pots every day, so these are kind of daily ritual practices, or a musician who has to practice every day, or a dancer who has to keep their body in shape by doing a series of exercises every day, right? These are ritualized activities, and they require a combination of things. So when we think of conservation originally comes out of kind of the sacred arts of kind of holding sacred objects like relics. And then they've been kind of transformed into the sort of artistic realm where art conservators and the conservators at the Holocaust Museum, many of them come out of that realm because that's the place where they were trained. And, of course, have to adapt those skills for this particular environment and these kinds of objects because, in an art museum, you might want to restore the painting to its pristine condition, right? But what makes these objects valuable and important historically is that they are tainted, right? They are compromised. They have schmutz on them because there's a diary by a handmade diary that was held by a partisan in the woods is not a pristine object, and you would never want to make it pristine because the whole point is that it carries the traces of that history in all of those marks. But that also means that the integrity of the object is compromised. The fight against kind of inherent vice, the kinds of things that disintegrate, is a really challenging concern. And so the arts become both an attentiveness to how the object was produced, when it was produced, how to date it, how to figure out, you know, if there was a bullet hole in a jacket, when was that bullet hole, when did that happen, right? Did it happen as a part of the war? And these are the kinds of things that become part of the historical story. But the conservator also has to be trained in a kind of science because they have to know what the materials are that made the object to begin with, how those materials were produced at that time and by whom, what kind of temperature would best preserve that object. Some things are put in cold storage because cold is a way of slowing down certain kinds of chemical processes. So that the arts mean all of the kinds of skills that these professionals bring to caring for or tending to these objects.
Would you share with our listeners, please, the story that you tell us about a certain green sweater?
Oh, that's a beautiful and powerful story. So in the beginning of the Holocaust Museum chapter, I talk about this small child sweater that was worn by a very young girl who was in the Lvov ghetto, and she escaped through the sewer system, and she wore this sweater. The sweater was handmade before the war by her grandmother, and this tiny, and it's quite tiny object, sort of carried her as she escaped the ghetto and ultimately later survived the war. And she held on to this object, and she bequeathed it to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And part of what's so amazing is that this sweater is very, very delicate, so it has to sit in a very careful box in order to be maintained. It was on display as a part of a special exhibit, but because it's so fragile, it really can't be a part of the permanent exhibit. But what the museum has done is they've created something called the Curator's Corner, and the curator in this case was this amazing woman named Susie Snyder, and I had the benefit of being on a panel with her and Jane Klinger yesterday at the Jewish Studies Association meeting. Your listeners will understand that this was in December, but Susie interviewed Karen, the woman who wore this sweater. It was her sweater. And tells the story. They show us the sweater, and they tell the story. And this is available and open to the public through the website at the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. And there is a kind of afterlife to the sweater as well. So many, many people have been very, very moved by this story and by this sweater. And part of the challenge of Holocaust memory is that because so many people, millions of people died, and there are no graves, and there are so few tangible ways of expressing our grief, that this is part of why the Holocaust Museum has so many objects and why I believe they're so powerful. So in the last couple of years, the museum store has worked with a series of knitters, and they have now created a pattern so that knitters can knit a version of this sweater. And I know probably for some of you it will sound kind of creepy, but what I want to come back to is I also want to just think about how loss is so palpable and physically experienced, and yet to have no way of marking this. And I think that for someone who knits, which is, of course, again, a kind of repetitive, ritualized activity, and it takes a lot of time and patience, and it's a way of meditating on that loss. And so I think about those knitters in that way. And strangely, a couple of years ago, I was telling a colleague at the Jewish Studies Association meeting about my work, and I talked to her about the green sweater, and all of a sudden she said, you know, I just flew in from Buffalo to Washington, and I was sitting next to a woman, and she was telling me this story that she was a test knitter for this project out of the Holocaust Museum, and it turned out she was a test knitter for the green sweater.
Wow.
And, you know, it was just a remarkable moment, and there were so many remarkable moments like this in the process of writing this book, and that's something that I write about in that last chapter, about the kind of serendipity, the kind of, you know, these kind of moments where I just feel like, oh, the universe is telling me that I'm on the right track. Things are coming together. But I just, I really admired that story, and, you know, again, in my own complicated feelings, I'm not a knitter. And I actually have another colleague who has written a book about Jews and all kinds of handicrafts, but particularly knitting and sewing. And she also writes about the green sweater in a different way. And of course, there's not one story to tell. The ways in which we breathe life into these stories and keep Holocaust memory alive is through this ongoing engagement with this past and the objects occasion more telling. And that's what's animating, and that's what's life-giving.
I thought it was interesting that you also, as you discussed this, mention in a sense a sort of tension, a tension, you say, that haunts the logic of the museum in terms of how it houses and presents many of these objects. In the telling of this, you tell a story of an official at some other Holocaust museum being asked in a publicity photograph to pose with a single child's shoe, I mean, an artifact from the Holocaust, and how wrenching this was for this person. But then you contrast that single child's shoe with what we might otherwise see, which might be a mountain of such shoes, a very powerful graphic demonstration, in a sense, of the scope of the Holocaust and the monstrous loss that it represents. But the power of a single object versus the power of many, many objects, each of those says something quite different. And in a sense, the one, while more monumental, is in a sense less intimate. I thought that was really, really fascinating, and I suspect... like us who are reading about this, this maybe never had dawned on you until you began to really examine this closely.
I think that's a really important point. And again, we kind of need both, right? We need to be reminded of, you know, the vast loss that is the Holocaust. We need to understand those mounds of shoes and hair and suitcases and eyeglasses. We need to recognize and reckon with that, but they are so vast that it's hard to wrap our heads around what that constitutes. We know it's huge numbers, right? We get that. But at the same time, if we slow down, and some of my colleagues from the museum were saying that often people go, there's a whole space at the museum in Washington that is devoted to the shoes, and it's kind of all on its own, and there are open bins of shoes. And first you see all of those open bins, right? And you see lots and lots of shoes. But many people stay and just kind of hang out there because they're so moved by it. And slowly as they kind of acclimate, They begin to see, they begin to be able to individuate. They begin to see individual shoes. They see color. They see size. They see mending. All of those things that make for the specificity of each of the shoes. But I think it's the interplay between the two. And we are fortunate to have stories, to have objects that have stories, that have biographies, so that knowing the story of that green sweater is just a really powerful and important reminder of the individuality of survivors and those who died.
You also say something that I think is really important in all of this. At one point you write, we risk fetishizing artifacts, granting them magical power to invoke the past of which they are only traces. And at other points you talk about how these objects, for as precious as they are only shards. And I'm reminded of when I had the privilege of interviewing Alexandra Zapruder some years ago about her book Salvaged Pages, about Holocaust diaries of young people, like the diary of Anne Frank, and how she said that in the wake of the publication of Anne Frank's diary, much was written that she thinks did a disservice because it made it almost seem like Anne Frank still lives because we have her diary and the diaries of these other young people whose lives ended in the Holocaust. And that when we say that about something like something even as beautiful as Anne Frank's diary, we are in a sense trying to evade the ultimate tragedy of the Holocaust and the monumental loss that it represents. I had not thought of that until I read this passage of your book about these objects that, for as important as they are, they are just objects and just a tiny part of a much larger story.
Yes, and that's the tension, because we can get caught up in the, again, we so long for something to hold on to that, you know, that could be good, right, and affirming. And that's the difficulty, right? It's the difficulty as we engage with such horrific legacies of unbearable trauma and violence and loss. And I think that what makes the objects powerful is our tender regard for them. Mm-hmm. But our access to them is always partial, and that's the other thing about telling lots of stories. All of our tales are only partial. That's part of what this means. It's not like, oh, here's the definitive story and we're done. Because we can never have access in the ways that you talked about this, the tragedy is so great. The horror is so great. But we get little bits, and we attempt to do justice to the lives and deaths of those people by attempting to tell some of these stories in their partialness.
Mm. You write at one point, these modern relics carry a kind of living presence. They continue to bristle with memory. We're speaking with Laura Levitt about her book, The Objects That Remain. I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about some of what is written in the third chapter of the book called In the Potter's Hands, in which you, among other things, share some of the profound thoughts of Potter Edmund Duval, who was a friend of yours for a time and actually around the time of your rape and was of comfort to you. And he says such interesting things about pottery, and in particular, how pottery and stories have an interesting connection with one another, in a sense, parallel lives. Tell our listeners about this connection that I think would never dawn on most of us.
Well, you know, I don't know him personally, but I feel so intimate with him because I've lived with his texts and his writings for so long.
Thank you for the correction.
No, but I love that you got that sense, because his writing is so beautiful and so powerful, And so a potter has to delicately work with this material and has to feel his way into figuring out when a vessel is sound, right, and how it works. And in many ways, that's how, certainly, that parallels the sort of writing process, that you kind of, you bring together lots of material, and you work it, and you work it. And sometimes something doesn't work, and you have to start all over again. But that practice, again, we're talking about this kind of ritualized activities, and that's certainly part of what the potter does. But I was particularly taken by Duvall's writing, and then learning about him as a potter, and then reading more of his work. He wrote a beautiful book about porcelain. And I write in the book that at the time that I was raped, I was falling in love with a man who was a potter. And I spent a lot of time in a pottery studio with him and other potters. This was at a beautiful art center in Atlanta that was a former Coca-Cola estate. And I fell in love. I've always loved clay, but I fell in love with pots and pottery. And this man who I was falling in love with gave me many beautiful gifts from his own hands. And those objects were with me at that time, and I still have them now. And they are a reminder of the tender regard that he had for me then, and for the ways in which I was held in the best sense of the word, at that time, in that place. And I have these beautiful objects still with me. They're now downstairs from where I'm talking to you in a former medical cabinet that's in my dining room. And they are reminders of love and loss and that time and that place. And they hold some of these memories for me.
Hmm. You call that cabinet a Wunderkammer, my world of things, my secret history of touch. And I so appreciate this because I think it's very easy, especially when one gets to a point in life where you're being sort of advised to purge so many of the objects that you have in your life that you have accumulated over the course of your life. And after a while, you just even subconsciously kind of get this idea that none of these objects matter. And the more you get rid of, the better. Your book reminds us of the importance of objects and also of what it means when we share them with others. You actually quote Duvall's book in which he says there are all kinds of different reasons for giving someone else an object. Because I love you, or because it was given to me, because I bought it somewhere special, because you will care for it, because it will complicate your life, because it will make someone else envious. But having suggested these reasons, he continues, there is no easy story in legacy. What is remembered and what is forgotten? There can be a chain of forgetting, the rubbing away of previous ownership as much as the slow accretion of stories. It's so interesting to think about stories and objects being wrapped up in one another.
And that's such a beautiful passage. It gives your listeners a real taste of why one might fall in love with Edmund Duvall and his writing. And I certainly did. And I think you captured that beautifully.
We have already touched on the fact that part of your exploration is of something very different from anything that we've talked about, and we won't have time to explore it, I'm afraid, but it is the whole matter of those objects that come into police custody, evidence that is held and sadly sometimes lost, as it was apparently in the case of your own rape. Just a very brief word is all we have time for, but I wonder if you could say a word about how valuable it was for you in your own life's journey to learn so much about the complexity of this part of police work, the holding and storing and custody of evidence.
Well, thank you for asking this question. I think that what I wanted to do was shed light on invisible labor. I did that with talking about what happens behind the scenes at the museum. with conservation and kind of collection management, but the police also are engaged in the work of custody. And unfortunately, the law thinks about the chain of custody as a kind of linear narrative, there's a kind of end point, a telos, and that is custody, and now we're done. And part of what I wanted to argue, having learned so much about what the police have to do in order to maintain and hold all of the evidence that is in their custody, is to talk about the kinds of work that that need to be done in order for evidence to be viable. So one, the police need to be able to find the evidence even 30 years later in case anything should have to go to court or could go to court. In addition to that, it has to be maintained in such a way that it doesn't disintegrate. So that if you're looking for DNA, that means that it has to be in the right temperature, in the right kind of container. And these are all pieces of that story. And if you have a rape kit, which is evidence taken from one's intimate body the night of a rape. So there's hair and other kinds of evidence taken from your body. And I certainly submitted to one of these exams myself. And only to learn in my case, and millions of other cases, alas, in the United States, to learn that evidence, that rape kit, was never processed. And so part of what shedding light on the work of custody does is it reminds us that custody is an ongoing labor, and that includes processing rape kits. But because we don't really talk about this, or we assume that, oh, it's taken care of because it's in custody, we lose sight of what has to happen in order to maintain those material pieces of evidence so that they can be viable. Mm. And that's part of what I tried to do in that chapter of the book. And, you know, my hope is that this helps explain, I talk about it as the logic of the supplement, that it's both necessary and it seems to be extraneous. But there's no legal case unless there's evidence. And so the work of police property management or custody has got to be something that we pay more attention to.
Mm. And you say how when we think about Holocaust objects as something like criminal evidence, it's also important to think about how criminal evidence should be thought of as Holocaust artifacts and in a sense held with similar regard. Your book finishes with a beautiful story in which you actually visit the house in Atlanta, Georgia, where this rape occurred, and you see this house largely renovated in a way that was oddly comforting to you, and you write the words, "Walls come down, new buildings go up, and what was destroyed is remade." In a sense, that is a very much a part of this important story shared in your extraordinary book, again titled The Objects That Remain. Published by Pennsylvania State University Press, the author, Laura Levitt. Laura Levitt, thank you for giving the world this truly important book, and thank you for being part of The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for this amazing interview. I am just so honored to be here with you. Thank you.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am happy to be reconnecting with Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, for his first Morning Show visit of 2021. And we'll be looking back at the tumultuous events in early January in our nation's capital and what's ahead for President-elect Joe Biden. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, which has just launched an RN to BSN program. Practicing nurses with an associate degree can complete a Bachelor of Science in Nursing in 16 months, taking a mix of online and on-campus courses. You can go to carthage.edu/BSN for more information. We're approaching 9 o'clock.